What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, it's all about the iPad Pro and the new iPad Air. There's a big Apple event this week, although I guess not really big, right? It was just a video stream, but we reorient our entire lives around it. And there are also events in New York and London for people to go on and try that out. So we'll be diving into Apple's new iPads and kind of what they mean, because this new iPad Pro is kind of interesting, just the way Apple is positioning it and thinking about it. So we'll be diving into all that. Also, the Pixel 8a, also some news from Sony and Xbox and everybody. But as always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Always love your feedback. We also typically live stream the show Thursday mornings around 10:30 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel. So, you know, follow us there. Keep an eye out for that. Timing may change, but I usually update that on social media. So I'm at Devendra on Twitter. Let's talk about these new iPads, which we have been waiting. I feel like we've had iPad stuff prepped, Sherlyn, for a couple of weeks because the MacBook Air event happened.
We keep expecting it, yeah.
We keep expecting it. And it also feels like we're getting close to WWDC. But this was the week. Apple finally debuted the new iPad Pros, which have an M4 chip, OLED displays, the first time outside of the iPhone and Apple Watch for Apple to be using OLED. Also, a wild new OLED display. They're calling it Tandem OLED because it's essentially two OLED panels on top of each other, which is one of those, like, I guess the technology has existed before, but this is one of those, like, Apple-y things of, like, everybody complains about the thing about OLED is that it's not bright enough, and, it, like, in some ways, it doesn't feel as, like, luminous as LEDs or especially mini-LED, which can get really, really bright. But you put two OLED panels on top of each other, then you get to something really interesting. So the display is interesting. The build is interesting because it's using OLED. These are crazy thin tablets. So there's a new 11-inch iPad Pro and 13-inch, which is really just a 12.9-inch, and they're just rounding up. The screen size hasn't changed at all, I believe. But we have those. But because they're using OLED, Apple has also been able to make them thinner than before and lighter. The 13-inch, I think, is particularly impressive because they're saying it is a quarter pound lighter than before. It is also the thinnest device Apple has ever made. It is 5.1 millimeters thick. That is thinner than an iPad Nano. If you're going to get pedantic, I see people talking about this on Twitter. It's not thinner than an Apple card. It's not thinner than the Apple credit card. Yeah. But that's not a...
Oh, no, don't even... The memes device. Were great because there was someone that was like, let's be honest, this is the thinnest thing Apple ever made. And then they pointed to a SIM ejector tool. And I was like, well
Apple card is technically... That's the thinnest thing Apple has ever made, but not device.
Yeah, Apple itself made.
Yeah.
It's different, yeah.
So the wording is funny. We have a hands-on from Nathan Ingram, who was in New York to do the event and to talk to people there and to actually test out these devices. But these just look really interesting. So we'll talk about the Airs in a bit. There are two new iPad Airs. But what do you think, Sherlyn, of this iPad Pro? Of, like, it is $200 more expensive than before, has a ton of new hardware, has a flagship, like the new chip before anything else. That's
what I was going to say. Yeah. To me, that's like the actual interesting piece of news here, right? That the M4 debuted on the iPad Pro. I think for me, the iPad Pro had reached a point of like, it's already really nice. I'll have to see it in person to really decide if that like whole super thin and maybe it's a bit lighter situation makes a big enough difference to be like, wow, I'm so truly impressed. This is really worth a $200 delta. But to Tony Talks' point in the live chat, right? He's like, or they're like, who was asking for the iPad to be so thin though? And I'm like, yes, why did it's I know
true.
That
it's
like getting rid of bezels at some point was like, yeah, good for aesthetics, but and also for like an immersive viewing experience. But then like my thumbs had to relearn where to be placed on the
screen. And the iPhones actually got thicker, right? Like as Apple reached a point with the iPhone, they got thicker because they had to like cram in different materials and build them differently too. And I didn't mind it. I actually thought it felt nice to have a weightier iPhone in my hand. Just it felt more substantial in a way.
It depends really for me. Like for a device like the iPad Pro, like is thinness such a big issue? Is weight such a big issue, especially at the point it's currently at? Like your whole use case for a device like this is on your lap, in the on the plane, on the tiny tray table, that sort of thing.
But you're holding it.
We're already at a point where it fits. Right. We're not really, well, for holding as a tablet, yes. But how many, okay, maybe sound off in the chat or send us an email at podcast@engadget.com. But like, are you using the iPad Pro more as a tablet or as a like a two-in-one stand-in?
I would.
Like, laptop yeah. replacement.
I mean, the way I've historically used any iPad is that they are sold as a tablet. They're positioned as a tablet, right? The OS sure, is yeah. built around the tablet experience. So I do think the idea of a 13-inch iPad Pro always seemed a little ridiculous to me, like way back since when they started doing this. It was too expensive. It was too large. And like we've all handled like 13, 15-inch 2-in-1s. I'm like, I'm never going to use this as a tablet. I'm never going to hold it up and use it as a tablet. But to shave a quarter pound off the 13-inch, to bring the 11-inch under a pound, it does make a difference when you're on a plane and like you don't always have space on your tray table to put something down, right? So you may have to hold the tablet in your hand, or you're just sitting in bed and there's like nowhere to like put it down, so you're holding the device. I think the holdability of the 13-inch is interesting, but yeah, it's not. These things are already super thin. They're already super thin. They're already pretty light.
My thing is, if you want something that hangs out in your like hands, right? And something that's like lightweight for that sort of multimedia consumption use, you have the iPad Air. There's like other things that don't need to have the Pro label. You don't need something as powerful. So why is thin and light so important? It's the same thing as like 15 and 16 inch notebooks. We like them for their power. We like them for the big screens. We like them for battery life. We don't need to tote them around all the time, so size isn't that big of a deal. Like it's a big deal, yes,
yeah,
but it's not big enough to like we have to be fighting for the Guinness Book of World Records sort of situation here, you know?
I don't know. And also, this is all tied, by the way Apple presented this idea is this the ad where they crushed a lot of things like instruments and toys and all things together to symbolize like, hey, like those old YouTube crush videos and the TikTok crush videos, hey, we got all this in the iPad now. It is, I think Apple's a very good company at marketing, but man, did they misread this particular one. Because I don't know if you've seen Trillin, because all people are doing online now
I've seen all the commentary.
Hating this ad, because symbolically, it is everything artists and professionals are worried about, is that a company like Apple, with devices like these, which they're also touting AI in this, in the M4 chip, because it has really high-level AI processing, it is a symbolization of technology crushing the liberal arts. And I think Apple has always been a company, like back from the Steve Jobs thing, what differentiated it was like, hey, we're not just a gray IBM PC box. We're not just freaking Windows here, boring ass nerds. We are people who like music. We like art. We like design, well-designed technology. And that has always been the idea. So I saw somebody who kind of, they fixed the ad by just reversing it. And that is actually kind of brilliant, because so it starts with the crush thing, it opens up, you see the iPad, and then out of that comes all the stuff, all the instruments, all the artwork, everything that would spring out of an iPad. And I just think symbolically, that's an easy fix. And it should have, I wish somebody at Apple had looked at this and been like, just do it the other way. We want this to be full of things, not to be literally crushing people's hopes and dreams and art, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The reverse is true. This is actually very accurate. I do like, there is quite a conversation going on the live chat. Jonathan Anderson, when we were talking about the thinness of the iPad Pro, by the way, was like, but can you cut bread with it? And I'm like, yo, Apple, if you like did an ad with the iPad slicing bread, I would be like,
you could cut bread with this. We could cut tofu with this. Like, this is a good, like, so I like a nice stuff. Dull edge for this. I just want to shout out the person who did the reverse ad is Reza 6075, who's an actor who's worked on movies like A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. So good idea. Simple idea.
Yeah. Also, Jonathan Anderson and Mark Dell are both pointing out, and I'm sure we will get to this later in the episode, but the Air is actually heavier than the Pro. The Pro is literally lighter than the Air.
Yeah, so
we will be getting there soon.
Literally, the title of that post is The Pro is Lighter Than Air Now. And it is funny. I've seen some Apple, like, Apple fanboys and Apple, like, people who really focus on Apple for reporting are like, hey, Air was just a name, man. It's not literally supposed to be the lightest one. I'm like, guys, I think Apple itself is a little confused with its own messaging here. Another thing I want to mention about the Pro, and I ended up writing that follow-up piece after they announced this, is that there's also a new Magic Keyboard. And I think, for me, the new Magic Keyboard kind of looks sick as hell. Like, because it has an aluminum top cover, it has the function row, it has a larger touchpad. So it looks like the key, like, board, basically, of a MacBook. And to me, like, we're getting closer to that idea of, hey, this device doesn't need to be so thin, but it is incredibly thin. It is very powerful. Has a like one of the best screens, most likely, that Apple has produced, because it's double freaking OLED. To have a device like this that just like slips into a tote bag or something, to me, I just feel like that's the future in a way. So like, it was definitely hitting my like gadget lust sensibilities of like all the years I spent looking at the iPad Pro and saying, this is kind of silly. It's too expensive. The 13 inch is too big. Who really needs all this power in a tablet? I don't think Apple has ever really proven that, even though they've shown us a couple apps like Final Cut, right? I don't think people really needed that, like a super powerful tablet, basically. But I am now, it's like Inception. Like the idea is now in my head of like, this is what if? What if I could just live entirely on this beautiful, gorgeous, thin machine that does everything I want? Like, it sounds nice. It's not realistic, but it's nice. Yeah.
I mean, I think we're circling around the same question again, which is like, the iPad Pro seems super powered, and do we need a tablet that's as super powered as this? Like, I don't think I have an answer for it. Question, Devendra, also from the chat, Mark Dell said, did they remove some cameras from the iPad Pro?
That's a good question. I don't know if they removed cameras because the rear is just, it is a new sensor. Plus, they're saying it is a True Tone flash. So better for scanning documents, which is apparently a thing Apple is selling. So if you show a document in front of the camera app, it will like do a better job of capturing that.
Seems like they removed the ultra wide camera on the iPad, which some people are sad about in our chat. And I'm like, I don't know
what you have your phone for, people. Like the rear camera on an iPad has always been like, hey, just you're talking to
Am
somebody.
Am I judging you?
Yeah, point it. Maybe I don't know. I feel like that's what a phone for. They did move the webcam to the side, to the
landscape. The horizontal bezel. Yeah,
the horizontal bezel side. So that's a good move. I have a Tensor and iPad, and that was really nice. Like, because I spend every night at dinner, I have to FaceTime my parents so my kids can talk to them. So that has been a really useful thing, change in my life. So that's the iPad Pro. We have, they're incredibly powerful, but they're also so much more expensive. The 11-inch starts at $999. The 13-inch starts at $1,299. At least they come with 256 gigabytes of storage now, but at the base model. But the price is still kind of messy because then you have to spend another $300 or $350 for the Magic Keyboard if you want that. Do you want different types of storage? Do you want like the cool nano etch screen that Apple's talking about? Well, then you got to pay for the 1 terabyte option, which really rockets up the price to the point where it's like you're paying for a MacBook, basically. That's what it kind of feels like. That seems like overkill. Yeah.
You made a point in your piece, right? That like, if you want to get the specs and the accessories to turn this into sort of a decent laptop replacement, you're paying like close to $2,000, and that you might as well get a very good laptop. Like you could get a very thin and light, very powerful laptop with a proper keyboard and like in some cases a touchscreen. Question from the chat again, sorry, because they're just asking such great questions. Chuck D is like, can we play GTA 5 on the iPad Pro?
Did they release it on mobile? I don't know if they release it.
I mean, you I could think theoretically,
it. You
asking.
Could stream it to the iPad. Listen, these are just like, they're just screens now. So if you use something like the Steam Link remote app or the PlayStation remote app, or just play stuff on other services like Xbox Cloud Gaming, I don't think GTA is there. But if you can cloud game GTA, you could do it that way. The iPad stuff is getting better. Or the Apple chips are getting better at full-fledged games. So I've seen Resident Evil 4 and Resident Evil Village playing like full scale. I played Life of Pi on several like MacBooks and stuff recently, even the MacBook Air. So you can play a lot of games on these. I believe the thing about GTA 5 is that it is what, Sony console exclusive now? Like when it, or no,
I,
no, it's on
you're
everything.
Asking the GTA wrong
5.
Person,
GTA
sorry.
5 is on everything. I don't know. I have to check the App Store. I can't do that in the middle of this recording. But I do know like the GTA collection, the smaller games came out on the App Store. So that was a whole thing. You can play a lot of games on these. Like that's the ultimate takeaway. It's not primarily a gaming machine, but Apple is getting to the point where you could do a lot more gaming on an iPad or any other devices, to be honest.
Well, I think we've covered the iPad Pro, and I think without really delving into a full review, we just haven't got a lot more.
You like
to
the pencil,
say, but the iPad.
Did you have something to say on the pencil?
I was going to say. Yeah. There was a whole new Pencil Pro. And like, look, going into the event, it was like, there were rumors, there's going to be a new Pencil. And I was like, why is that exciting? And then the news came out and it was like, we have a squeeze sensor in the barrel now. And also, there was one more thing. I just got so caught up in the whole squeeze thing that I was like, wait, what? You wouldn't squeeze a pencil? And then if y'all saw our social media, at Engadget on Instagram, I think, the caption that went up was like, oh yeah, the new pencil has a squeeze barrel. And then the part where it's like, just don't be weird. That part was me. I was like, just, you guys don't be weird with this. Like, don't get weird with your pencils.
I mean, where is your mind going, Trulin? You have other styluses have had squeeze gestures before.
But like, what are you squeezing out? Is it like toothpaste? Are you squeezing ink out?
You know what I mean? Like, you're squeezing to like make, it's like,
I'm not as dumb as I see.
I know.
But it's just now you're making really me worried.
So we did do a piece, by the way.
I don't manage anybody.
Shout out to Jeff Dunn's piece. The Apple Pencil lineup is a mess. So here's a guide to which one you should buy. It is true. There are several. There's the Pencil Pro, which is this new one, right? The Apple Pencil second generation, the Apple Pencil USB-C. There are other pencil-like devices out there. I have the Logitech Crayon, which I really like. My daughter has really liked that one for doing like drawing and stuff. So you have got a bunch of stylus options. And again, that's also something you can't do on a MacBook, right? So why would you buy a super power or super expensive iPad Pro? If you're a creative who already has like a super beefy ass machine at work, at home, or the office,
like a Wacom,
and you just need to like do stuff on the go and your company is paying for the craziest machine you can think of, then sure, makes sense. And then you can do some stylusing stuff too. But okay, pencil done. iPad Air. We have a new 11-inch iPad Air, a new 13-inch iPad Air. The thing about these iPad Airs is that they're basically just the M2 iPad Pros, right? They took that hardware down. They don't have Face ID sensors. They also don't have something else I was thinking of that they don't have. Basically stripped down iPad Airs starting at what, $599? That sounds about right.
I'm not sure what that I think there is one thing we forgot on the iPad Pro, by the way. Wasn't there some kind of textured glass on the screen?
I talked about that, nano textured glass. If you want that, that's not super important. But if you want that, that is another $100 you're spending. So
that's another upgrade, you did say in your post. I don't know. I'll have to touch it to find out for myself. But you're right. Like the iPad Air is the M2 without those things that you mentioned. And then I think Jonathan Anderson in the chat saying that it's no OLED as well.
No OLED. No. Oh, that's the other thing. It doesn't have ProMotion. So
yes, now 120 hertz. Yeah.
Now your choice is right. iPad Air 11-inch starts at $599. I have seen the M2 iPad Pro refurbished or used on eBay for around the same price. And if it's like between those specific models, I would say get a used iPad Pro, because ProMotion, the high refresh rate makes a big difference. That is a higher quality screen, I believe, too, because those were mini LED screens. And I don't care about Face ID, but hey, you get Face ID too.
Like Face ID. Yeah,
it's fine. I mean, with an iPad, it's probably fine because you're not like wearing a mask. It's not like your phone where you may be outside wearing a mask or something, and it's like tough to get to. Kind of makes more sense. What do you think of the new Airs though? Because there's a 13-inch for the first time. They're now $599 and $799, which are significantly cheaper than the Pros. And we have talked about how the Pros are just like, they're so expensive. And I don't even think Apple has really tapped into all the power that they offer everybody. And at the base level, the 10th-gen iPad still around, that is now $349, right? So the deal hound to me is like, you can do a lot with a 10th-gen iPad. You could do a lot with those things. So
Okay. So we're reaching like Samsung territory over here, right? We're reaching the point where like, remember we gave Samsung a lot of crap in the past for like, so having so many different phones for so many different segments that it gets very confusing. Like the choice is even harder. And I think that's where we're at with the iPad lineup right now. I wonder if like, I think we were thinking about doing sort of a guide as to like, what iPad should you buy? Who is the iPad Air for? Like that sort of idea. And like the iPad Air is like, who is it for? If you're listening, if you're watching, leave us a note. Like, would you buy the iPad Air? And if so, why? Like, what are you using to justify that price?
I can see
that $599 price over the $349 for the 10th gen iPad. Or why aren't you upgrading to the Pro?
But the Pro is so much more expensive. Like, by the time you start like speccing the Pro, like it is almost twice the price of what an iPad Air would cost you. I've seen this because I've had this like thought in my hands, like I would love a super light writing machine that I can take anywhere. That's not like carrying around the laptop, right? And so what I ended up doing is I got a 10th gen iPad and one of those Logitech like combo folding cases, and it's fine, but it's not like great. It doesn't feel good for typing. Whereas with the Air, it is a better design. It's a better screen. I think the screen just looks nicer, and you have the option of the other Magic keyboards, right? So you have the older Magic keyboard, you have other better keyboard options. So I feel like for people who want to be productive and want something more than the basic ass, you know, tension iPad.
Right, right.
That's the thing. My daughter is starting to play Minecraft a lot, and I didn't think anything would really use the power of like even the modern tension iPad, but it's great to be able to load a huge Minecraft map really quickly. You know, like people are doing more with iPads. I've seen people video editing on iPad Airs and iPad Pros. I know people who base their entire work lives around iPad Pros and can even produce podcasts from them and edit them too. So it is getting there. Like Apple is getting there towards this sort of dream of like supreme mobile computing. But at the same time, like if you want to really get work done, you need a MacBook. You know, you need a desktop OS. It's just funny to see Apple have these two tracks and then the Air is just sitting there in the middle. So I don't know. Yeah. Podcastinggadget.com. Let us know. What would you use an iPad Air for? Would a used Pro make more sense? I think it does, to be honest. All right, enough of Apple stuff. Let's talk about some Google stuff. And Google, in its complete wisdom, right, really just want to take on Apple with Apple's big news. It's like, hey,
no. I argue with the like the
I know the dates were set
chronological
before.
Order yes, of things.
I know the dates
because I'm
were
like
set
I
before.
Think
yeah.
Yeah, I think Apple announced it after Google set up plans with us in the background, but I couldn't be 100%.
Oh, okay. Well, then anyway. I'm not privy to all that, but it does look kind of funny. The same day we got the iPads, Google has announced the Pixel 8a, the cheaper Pixel 8. It's $499, has a really nice OLED screen. What's going on with that, Sherlyn?
I mean, this is basically everyone's favorite A series device, but for 2024, it is a big Pixel 8a. For $500, you're getting a 120Hz OLED screen, which, by the way, gives like I'm concerned about the battery life because of that. Like, it's a lot of upgrades in one generation to the display, and we always used to like the A series for their like just never-ending battery. So we have to wait till we do a full review to find out. But I mean, on paper, it's very interesting. And Sam Rutherford, our senior reviewer, went and took a look at it, got a hands-on with it. You can see the video on our YouTube channel for yourself. But here's a like 6.1-inch OLED screen, which is slightly smaller than the Pixel 8 from last year, which is 6.2 inches. And it has kind of like larger bezels on the 8A. So like in terms of the handset size itself, I think it's about the same as the 8, but the screen is just surrounded by slightly thicker bezels on the cheaper phone. And then, you get all those AI features that you saw on the Pixel 8. So things like, I guess, Magic Editor, which is technically free to everyone now. But like, if you're not a subscriber to Google One or a Pixel owner, you have like a limit of 10 saves a month. Whereas if you own a Pixel phone like the 8 or the 8A, there's no like limit. You can go ham. So the biggest thing you'll miss from like the Pixel 8 Pro and Pixel 8 on the Pixel 8 is like a pro camera mode. So pro camera controls manual like adjustment of shutter speed, ISO, white balance, and all those stuff. The 8A also has just the same T wireless charging standard, which is 7.5 watts, not the new like up to 18 watts on wireless charging on some other phones. And there's no actual dedicated telephoto lens on the Pixel 8a. So if you really need a camera that you can rely on during concerts and whatnot, there is digital zoom, but the quality isn't going to be as good as something like a dedicated telephoto lens is going to offer. So, I mean, this is, by all like impressions so far, a really solid looking phone for the money.
$500, really nice features.
Yeah. $500, a 120Hz OLED screen. First time for the Pixel A series, not say in this price range altogether, but I don't know. I've always liked the A series, so I'm very intrigued to see. However, I will just allude to something. I will come back and bring this point back up on the podcast later on, but just know that it's not fun to have an embargo review go up on the same day as iPad launch.
Yeah, not fun. Not fun. This is sometimes the news, like sometimes we're begging for news and sometimes we were like flooded with it and we're just dying. So anyway, folks, Pixel 8a seems really nice. And I don't know. I kind of don't know where this fully sits in the Android ecosystem at this point. But how does it compare to like the cheaper Samsung models we talk about, Trillin?
I mean, I couldn't give you like a direct specs comparison right now, but I will say that like for me,
you know, AI could give you that direct specs comparison right now, Trillin.
FYI. Just to help you out. They would give me the wrong specs.
Absolutely.
Yes. But I will. I gotta say, like Pixel and Samsung, you'll see the same kind of battle in their flagship phones and in their affordable phones, which is that Pixel will always give you, and this is slightly subjective, but like for me, a better camera experience. I prefer the Pixel camera experience. And if you're a Samsung fan, fine. It's almost like parody nowadays, except for in low light.
You get a better Zoom experience than Samsung, right? They're good on the Zoom.
Hardware-wise, yes, they're actually good. But I have to say, Google has a better like cleanup in terms of software. They have better like, that's why Night Sight is such a like crazy good thing. It's because software-wise, noise reduction on Google's processing algorithms is much better, cleaner. Anyway, the other area that I think Google has the advantage is they often always have better software. And with all the AI features that we saw come out on the Pixel 8, even though Samsung has done its best to mimic a lot of it in the S24 series, I still think the Pixel UI has my heart. I think I like features like call screening. I like features like recorder. You know, I just charged up the Pixel 8 sitting at in my living room just to use it during the iPad Pro event, because having a live transcription as the show is being broadcast is very helpful to me, because I can always go back and see what I missed when I was assigning a story or something. Like, I'm like, oh yeah, that's what they said on
this, by the way, nice AI feature that helps you like work better too. I actually did that during the iPad event by just like having my iPhone like open on Evernote, and just I hit the dictate thing. I was like, just do your thing.
Yes.
And it is helpful for going back and looking at notes.
It's so helpful. Yeah. It's so helpful. And like, this is my pro tip for everyone. If you have a Pixel phone, especially or an Android phone that you can get the recorder app on. I'm not quite sure actually if it's limited to Pixel phones only right now. They've, you know, trickle down so many of their apps and features. But if you have Google's Recorder app and you're taking a meeting that's going to run very long and you know you're not going to be paying full attention the entire time, leave your Recorder app on and then flip over to the transcript page, because then you can just scroll back up and read.
Oh, well, it can also summarize it for you now too, right? Or is that not?
It can also summarize at the end of it, like not live. But this, I'm talking about live. Like literally like right now when you and I are talking to Vindra, if someone on chat had like the Recorder app transcript going, they could scroll back up and see what we just said.
This is true.
without having to like affect the stream.
I just like what's the term people have been using for like for quiet quitting? Sherlyn's tips for quiet quitting and not paying attention to work is use AI to record all your meetings and make it seem like you're paying attention.
You heard it here first on the Engadget podcast. This explains a lot, actually. Quiet quitting.
This explains a lot of my meetings with Sherlyn. Yeah. Trillin's just like
how to fight burnout.
Absolutely.
But yeah, that's where I think you know, Google's advantages are, even in the like affordable/mid-range phone arena. Samsung obviously continues to have the edge in display. And I think if you want a more iPhone looking device, I guess you can pick the Samsung one, because it's got the more, you know, rounded rectangle look. And then, you know, Pixel's still, you know, the Pixel 8a still has that camera bar that looks like a kind of a Cyclops situation in the back. So there you go. The Pixel 8a, I think we have to wait for a full review to see about whether that, you know, 120 hertz OLED screen saps battery like crazy, and then other performance type things related to Tensor G3, and to see whether it's worth like recommending you all spend your money on. But I know a lot of people have already pre-ordered it.
It's a nice phone. Cool. It's a nice phone, especially for the Android folks. I wish there were more options like this in Apple land other than the iPhone SE, right? Yeah, even the base iPhone, I guess, is not that much more expensive, but still. Let's move on to other news. And there's a bunch of stuff out of the gaming world today, or this week. Specifically, I want to talk about what the hell happened to Helldivers 2, which was a sort of unexpected success story for Sony. It's a third-person shooter that they launched. The unique thing is they launched it on PC and PlayStation 5 at the same time. And it ended up kind of being a hit because it's a fun game to play. It has this cool like Starship Troopers sort of like comedy to it. It is like a comedy fascism. I don't know how you'd put it. But it's a fun game. It ended up being a great group game because I've played some multiplayer stuff with my brother. It was supposed to launch with PlayStation Network support or a requirement to log on to PlayStation Network when it initially launched on Steam, but that didn't happen because the game was super popular and, like, yeah, Sony just delayed that integration. But over this week, they brought that back. And when that happened, Sony did not think that PlayStation Network, even though Helldivers 2 was a game sold to everybody around the world via Steam, PlayStation Network is only available in 73 countries. So the people in the 100 plus countries around the world who don't have PlayStation Network basically had no way to play the game that they spent $40 on. That led to review bombing. That led to a lot of, like, social media hate against the company. I think even the social media manager was like, this sucks. Like, they were putting their thoughts out there. I know Ben, podcast producer Ben, has played quite a bit of Helldivers 2, and you've got thoughts on this, but let me just say, this feels like such a Sony move, right? Of like, hey guys, something's working. Something is actually working. But the Japanese bosses or the corporate bosses will be like, well, we got to get the network there. Like, I'm sure somebody with a spreadsheet was like, we got to get those PSN numbers up, and this popular game was the way to do it. So let's just do it, right?
Yeah, no problem. I think the thing that Jess mentioned in her article about monthly active users on PlayStation Network was exactly right. I've also seen some speculation that having the simultaneous, like, PlayStation Network account and also playing on Steam may help the problems that Helldivers was having with its friend request system.
Right, because right. Which is a mess. Yeah.
Helldivers was so janky at the very beginning. I think a lot of stuff broke because it just got way more popular than Arrowhead expected it to be right out of the gate. I think they launched it and they were going to, like, backfill online capability. They were ready for, like, 200,000 simultaneous players. They had way more than that and had to eventually cap it at 450,000 simultaneous players on their network. They were running around with their hair on fire trying to figure out how to just, like, make their servers not melt down.
Also, it's funny, they did not plan for success, right? They did not plan for extreme success with this thing, which feels like another sort of Sony problems. Like, they never treated PCs as, like, a first-tier gaming platform. It was always, like, the games will come out a year or so later, right? So to have a day-and-date PC and PlayStation release, they did not know how to prepare for that. Yeah,
I think it might also be a smaller developer. So, like, you can say all the bad things you want about, you know, the enormous game studios with, you know, their endless crunch and relatively uninspired, you know, basically Call of Duty 2K25 or whatever, but that thing is built for, like, a million simultaneous players on day one.
Yeah, they can spin up cloud servers, they can, like, spin up resources when they need to. And Arrowhead is not a big developer, right? This is not a first-party Sony game. This was a game that was kind of supported by Sony as a publisher. Sony has, like, the console exclusivity to it, too. So it feels like a Sony game. That's why they wanted all this integration in there. But, yeah, what a mess. So basically, right now, Sony has backed down. They're saying there's no PlayStation Network requirement for the PC, but the game is still not around. It's still not available in countries for future sales where there is no PlayStation Network access. So again, still sort of shooting themselves in the foot and sort of proving, like, hey, just put good stuff out there and don't put all these annoying limitations and content blocks and logins on it. And maybe people will actually want to play your games. I feel like that's a big lesson here.
So two things they could have done better. One, of course, only sell the game in the countries where PlayStation Network is going to be available. Two, I know this is, like, hindsight being 2020, but, like, if you still require the PlayStation Network login when people are first, like, purchasing and downloading the game at the very beginning of its life cycle, then everyone's like, okay, this is a little bit annoying, but, like, 2 weeks after they bought the game, they will forget that they have a PlayStation Network login anyway. They didn't do that. Your misfires are your own fault, and yeah, now you have to have a game that is supported all over the place and, like, figure it out on the back end.
Just hilarious. And also, I mean, listen, we're going to have some updates on the story, I'm sure. If you are a hardcore Helldivers 2 player and you have thoughts on this, let us know. Podcastandgadgets.com. We also saw the very sad news this week that Microsoft and Xbox are shutting down several studios. Arcane Austin, the studio behind Redfall, they were working on an update for that. That's done. Tango Gameworks, the one that produced Hi-Fi Rush and Ghostwire Tokyo, that was Shinji Mikami's studio, also shut down. And Alpha Dog Studios, which was working on Mighty Doom, I believe. Yeah, that's what I'm seeing from our report here. All shut down. Staff are going to like move around. These companies came to Microsoft as part of the ZeniMax deal, I believe, the Bethesda thing. Yeah, ZeniMax Media. So it's a whole bunch of things. A lot of layoffs. And what's interesting is that people have been very vocal in their criticism of this, including one of my favorite game developers and people in games right now, Dinga Bakaba. He's the co-creative director of Arcane Leon. They're the Arcane that does the Dishonored games and Deathloop and those other ones. But he specifically said, like, this is absolutely terrible. Permission to be human to any executive reading this. Friendly reminder that video games are an entertainment cultural industry, and your business as a corporation is to take care of your artists and entertainers and help them create value for you. Don't throw us into gold fever gambits. Don't use us as straw men for miscalculations and blind spots. Don't make our work environments Darwinist jungles. Damn. Like, this is somebody working for Microsoft, basically. Like, directly saying something against the executives. And he's also a well-loved person, so I'm sure he's probably not thinking too much about, like, his own, like, will they fire him for saying this? I think people have a lot of these feelings. There have also been reporting that the head of Xbox, Matt Booty, the ex-head of Xbox Game Studios, also said that he talked to, I think it was a live stream with the employees, but he had a talk yesterday where he was saying Xbox does need more small games to survive. And people also viscerally hated that because they're like, well, more small games like Hi-Fi Rush from the studio you just shut down. That sort of like commentary, I think, was not well liked. There's also reporting from Bloomberg that more Xbox layoffs are expected. They're offering voluntary severance agreements to producers, quality assurance testers, and other staff. So they are basically trying to get rid of full-time employees in other ways, maybe by paying them off, maybe by moving them to other portions of the company or something. So kind of a rough time for Xbox. This also comes after they have been reporting continual, like, you know, sales declines in hardware. They just have not been, because there aren't really many games to buy on Xbox. If you are a console gamer, you probably want to buy a PlayStation 5, and if you don't care that much, then you will buy a Switch, you know, or you'll wait for the next thing. So, just crummy. I know if you have feelings on this, Sherlyn, just bad times for the game industry.
I just think that the whole world is going through it, right? Like, I've heard of layoffs across all the industries. My friend works in the medicine/healthcare/pharma industry, and, like, they are, like, going through rounds and rounds of layoffs, and I think it's kind of the expected outcome of the hiring, like, craziness that happened during the pandemic. Everyone was buying things at home. Everyone was watching TV at home. Everyone was playing games at home all the time. So those industries boomed. And now, compared to 2020, everything feels like a decline, but it's not, right? We were comparing ourselves against a weirdly, like, high-performing year. Why are we comparing ourselves to that? Why are we comparing ourselves at all? Why do we have to grow every year? And, well, I mean,
because you got to appease the stockholders. That's why you have to grow and grow and grow and appease the investors. You're right that this is, like, a problem facing everything right now. I don't know if you saw this story, Sherlyn. Dell, the Register, reported that Dell is color-coding staff depending on how hybrid they really are in the RTO push. So they are color coding staff depending on how often they're going to the office. And like, oh, this person's more valuable. They're more committed. They're a better worker.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that is the
Yo, word. I'm gonna go into that the sucks. Office. I'm going to go to the office at Dell every day just to eat their snacks and do nothing. Nothing else.
So this has been like an ongoing story for a while. Dell has laid off a bunch of staff too, who they've been more stringent and saying, like, you got to return to office. If you're not, you have to leave. You have to leave the company. So this is the latest thing. And just like labeling employees, judging their worth depending on how many times they come to an office, that's really crummy. But it's also kind of a way to like weed out who's really committed, you know, and who is just costing us money by being a remote worker, even though a worker who comes into the office will be costing you money in other ways because they will be needing snacks and facilities and other things. So
You know,
it's also stupid.
I don't know about you, Devendra, but because when we were back in the office, I am like both more productive and less productive at the same time
it's
in an
just
office
different.
Because I waste a lot of time in the commute, right? Like I don't like to type in moving vehicles. I'm not working during my commute.
Oh, really?
Like screw that, right? The other, well, I mean, I'm on Slack, but whatever. And then the other thing is when I'm in the office in person, I am the sort of person that like I see people, I say hi, we talk, and we waste another 30 minutes talking to, say, my boss or like a person that's like
human connections. Yeah, the in person.
And that makes a difference. It's also kind of work, but it doesn't translate to productivity. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's to me, it is dumb. I'm like, don't judge your workers by whether they go to a physical location. Judge them by the quality of the work you put out.
Did we learn? Like, we have seen this even from the beginning of the pandemic, that people were being more productive because they were working from home. We've seen the studies where companies who allow flexible work time or even 4-day work weeks, people are more productive in 4-day work weeks because they're like, well, I like being here. I like having Friday, Saturday, Sunday off. So I'm going to like just focus. I'm going to like hustle on what I'm doing because I like this and I'm more committed to it. We've seen all this evidence of treating your workers better is better for productivity and could save you money in the long run. But I don't know. I do think like sometimes it feels like executives look around, you know, the people who come to the office and who have the nice big offices in the corner and they see empty rows of seats and they're like, nothing's being done here. Nothing like this company,
or they're
not doing
thinking about how they're wasting rent or something. I don't know.
I think that's also part of it too. But it is, hey, crummy for Dell. People are widely like, saying that that's such a mess too. But layoffs in the video game industry, we have charted a whole bunch of that. We've had a running tally for a while. Let me see what our number was just for last year. Last year in 2023, an estimated 10,500 people in the video game industry lost their jobs. Prior to today's to the closures this week, 9,400 people in the game industry have been fired in 2024, and we are not even halfway through the year. So,
and here's the thing: we're also only tracking the ones that have like a certain number of layoffs happen in one fell swoop. We're not tracking, say, companies, because I've heard from other friends in other industries that their companies are laying off people like one a week or a few people at a week, and they like coast under that sort of like not a big number radar, I guess. So we're not considering that either.
It's the other ways of getting rid of workers. There are so many ways that we have experienced personally. So hey, I hope companies learn to treat workers better, because hey, if you want people to be productive, maybe they should be happy about where they're working. Let's move on to news about Hades 2 is out in early access. So hey, Rare, good news in the game industry. I freaking love Hades 2. I've been playing. I got it like as immediately. This is the direct sequel to Hades. Sherlyn, I feel like you would like these games. Like you would like the first Hades. It is available on Switch right now. You should play it. But it's a very good like roguelike. So it is a game where you're going back and fighting through specific environments, which are randomized. But you have to keep going back and doing it. And as you're doing it, like a story unfolds. The original Hades story. This is a game by Supergiant Games. And I have loved everything they've done. I've loved Bastion. I've loved Transistor. They have great art style. They have great music, just great vibes, great writing too. So Hades, you were playing, what was it? The son of Hades, right? Who was trying to leave the underworld and fighting his way through and ultimately has to fight his father. Hades 2 is a direct continuation. I will not say like where it is, but it stars a character named Milenoe, who is also trying to leave the underworld and accomplish a certain goal. She is trying to kill Kronos, the god of time. And it's just such a cool setting. Their artwork is so good. The gameplay feels so good, so crisp. I love it. Like, I know I love a game within 5 minutes where I'm like, oh, I love the way this person runs around. I love the way they swing a sword or whatever. I just love the way it feels. And Supergiant has just kind of perfected that. And Hades 2 is like, you know, extra perfection there.
It sounded from your description like you were telling me about Vampire Survivors.
Vampire Survivors is a sort of game similar to this where, you will repeat the same thing over and over again.
Right.
But Vampire Survivors is an auto, I don't know, what's the term, auto battler? But it's a game where you're not like hitting a button to like swing your sword.
Gotcha.
That you're just like moving around.
So you actually have more that goes into the
Hades
process.
Requires like coordination and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I won't play it, right? Because you know my type of games. I
think you could try. I think Sherlyn, especially...
I will try.
It has great writing, very attractive characters that appeal to everybody. Like, it is very, like, very sexy game in many ways. Yeah.
Let me say something about that real quick. It's low-key a dating sim.
Oh. Yeah.
But you have to, like...
Reel me
fight
in.
Fight a bunch of monsters and stuff to, like, get... like little gifts that you can give to romanceable NPCs. Think about that. Just think about that.
Or make friends.
Are they hot?
Or whatever.
I mean,
what's also cool is that so I've been playing this with my daughter. I'm just spoiling my daughter with games here because it's sort of like we did Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom, which we played a couple hours every night. Then Chrono Trigger, we did a bit of Chrono Cross, and then she saw me playing this and she was like, "What is that?" And she is just like in love with the mythology and like, who is this character? Why do they do this? Why do they have these powers? So now she saw this and she's like, okay, I want to read about Greek gods now. I want to know these stories. So I bought her some children's books about Greek mythology. And that's kind of the path we've taken here. But it's because of Hades and how rich it is and how interesting these characters are. And the setting is so cool. Anyway, Hades 2 is great. If you like the first game, you can try it out in early access now on Steam. It is well worth it. Early access means that this is kind of a extended preview of the game. Like, things may change. The final version may change certain things. So, you know, sometimes progress gets erased, I think, when they do that. But I don't care. I will play this game over and over again. It is so good. Yeah. Let's move on to what's going on around Engadget. And shout out to Steve Dent, who reviewed the Fujifilm X100 6 VI.
Gosh, that thing looks so cute. Pictures came out so nice.
I don't know if you're spending... The pictures look great. The video looks great. Like, I don't know if you're spending time on YouTube, like, watching camera nerds. Sherlyn.
I know people love...
People love this camera. People are, like, going all over for it. I think the problem with the X100 5 is that... It was just never in stock. Like, Fuji could not make enough of them.
And the 6 is also kind of not in stock right now, from what I see.
So, hey, people love the design. I remember, I think we were testing, like, some of these several years ago, and it takes beautiful pictures. This is a cool-looking camera, but damn, is it expensive. Like,
Yeah, it is really expensive.
Like, this is big money. Like, if you're an influencer or something, like, I think that's why people are into these things, right? Because you can get beautiful images.
Yeah, it's very influencer aesthetic.
Yeah, you don't have to go in and, like, post-process too much stuff. Like, you get good JPEGs right out of this thing because you're using Fuji's color settings and everything. But damn, is it expensive. Like, I spent I justified buying Sony's A7C, which is their compact full frame camera, which is a beautiful camera, but that costs $2,000. This thing is almost at that price. This is a compact, not even full frame, not an interchangeable lens. Just a compact, you know, lens with, like, good image stabilization, has in-body image stabilization, has built-in ND filters for, like, really bright days and stuff. This is a good pocketable camera. And I'm just like, I cannot justify a price. What was, what, $1,500 now? Or close to $1,500? It is a very expensive thing, but damn, does it seem like the perfect camera. $1,600 right now. I also, the other thing people have now is a DJI Osmo Pro 3. And I spent the money on that. So it's like, that is the thing I want to spend time on to do, like, better video and produce things. But damn, is this cool. I don't need it, but damn, is this cool. So, yeah. Are you going to get this one? Do you have a new camera, Sherlyn? Like, a newish one?
No, I am still attached to the my Canon EOS.
What?
What is it? Like, a 5D?
A full DSLR?
I cannot remember.
Yeah, you still have
I love a full DSLR. No. Don't
okay,
even.
So this camera is made for people like Sherlyn, who should be moving on from the old...
I love
the old full-ass
trust.
DSLRs.
I want to get the Fujifilm. I cannot with Fujifilm's bodies, though. You know what I mean? Like, I love a Canon. Like, I'm so used to Canon's, like, controls.
But you're not even mirrorless right now. Like, you could go to a Canon mirrorless or something. But anyway, yeah, I do remember seeing your camera.
I
remember seeing you pull out your camera occasionally, Sherlyn, at events. And I was like, okay, let me get the forklift out.
I love the click of a DSLR. I just love that shutter.
You get you get a great click on mirrorless cameras. Come on, people. Yeah.
I don't
podcastinggadget.com.
I like the DSLR kick.
It is a good click. It is a very good click. I love the way those feels, but I also love the way how fast my Sony, like, clicks and it feels so good. Okay, let's move on to what we're working on. I am at some point going to do these Surface reviews because we had iPad day and I had an iPad thought right after that. That's why I wrote a piece basically saying, like, I think I want an iPad Pro. which seems insane to me. So the Surface reviews are going to come, or at least a quick one. And we're going to be prepping for Microsoft's Build event. There's more stuff happening next week. Yeah, a lot of stuff in the works. What about you, Sherlyn?
I am working on, as always, trying to not die.
Please don't.
No, everything.
We need you. Yeah.
I alluded to this just now when I was like, it's really fun when Pixel and Apple and all happening on the same day. There's that stuff I've publicly mentioned before, things like, hey, look at the calendar of events in May. And I've said that there's stuff y'all don't know about. The Pixel 8a was one of those things that I alluded to, but we couldn't say it was coming, right? Because it's under embargo. And so I just want you all to know that next week, what is it, the mid-May? Yeah, that's the mid-May with the teens week of May, is literally going to be the worst week for me. I think this first half of the year. Uh-huh. It is the worst.
Really?
Because publicly, just so you all know, publicly we know that Google I.O. is happening May 14th, 15th, maybe even 16th, sure. And then we know publicly that next week Microsoft is having its Build Developer Conference.
Those not next week, we not know. Next week, 2 weeks.
I'm sorry, 21st. 20, not yeah. next week, the week after is what I meant to say.
20 to 22 is Microsoft and, news, yeah.
Right, so then behind, we all know that before the events happen, we prep, we get ready, we brief, we plan. There's also
nervous.
Other events yeah. that we cannot talk about and happening at the same time. And it's kind of like, think about how that Pixel thing happened. Uh-huh. Think about, it's happening.
It's happening. As it's
well.
All happening.
Next week, I want to kill somebody. And it's not me. And it's not a real person. Uh-huh. I just want to squeeze some
This is what you do in your fitness industry. Classes, Sherlyn. Don't you just beat things up?
Yes. Yeah. I go squeeze sandbags and kettlebells.
And apple pencils,
and
apparently.
This is, and, ooh.
There you go. That's something.
There we go. Anyhow, that's what I'm working okay. on, and that's what I was trying
Frillin to do. Frillin is also working on herself, as we all are.
Always.
Yeah, I think that's yeah. it. Like, it's gross. Just managing this insanity. Like, let me tell you, it's also like, after having two kids, Frillin, also like our workflow and stuff, like, managing all this stuff is just like, you just have to learn.
I also wanted to shout out that this weekend is Mother's Day, but you know, some of us will be working this weekend mm-hmm. for reasons you will find out soon. But I'm also volunteering on May 11th at an event in New York City area, in Queens, actually. If y'all are interested, May is Asian American Native, NH, Native Hawaiian? Mm-hmm. Pacific Islander month?
I think so.
And so there's an event I'm volunteering at that is related to that general ASA tennis and Asian AAPI Heritage Month event. If you're interested, I have already posted the links publicly on like my socials. Go for it. Go check it out. But yeah, I'm also doing that outside of work. It's fun. I love to volunteer. I'm thinking of
you love to commit yourself
foundation
to more things, Sherlyn. Yes, yes.
I love
to
burn
spread
out.
Ourselves thinner and thinner.
All of that stuff.
It's great. It's great. Okay, well, that's great. If you're in New York, yeah, go hang out with Sherlyn,
yes,
maybe.
Yes, exactly.
Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. Anything you want to shout out, Sherlyn?
Yeah, so Simon B. in the chat actually asked if we could talk about this, so I will bring it up. Simon B. had asked if we could talk on, is Netflix innovating on live events, right? So we've noticed some shows happen live on Netflix now. I think the most recent one that I can remember, other than the roast of Tom Brady, which we will get
the
to.
The Mulaney stuff, yeah.
Or we won't get to because I didn't watch it.
Yeah.
I saw a recent episode of the Everyone's in LA show with John Mulaney, and honestly, it was kind of cringe to me because it was just a lot of like comedians sitting around. Well, not all comedians, but some comedians.
That's
like,
live. That's live.
Was
like,
there.
Yeah.
Right. That's what live is you sit around and try to make jokes, but they don't all land, right? Because it's live.
It depends. And, like, and maybe because I was raised on Conan O'Brien, right? And I watched him like struggle.
Conan's great.
Conan's great.
I loved it live.
But I don't know if you watched him in the 90s, Sherlyn, when he had to like struggle
not
to make people
90s,
laugh
no,
at 12:30 a.m. at night. You know,
yeah.
It was a
yeah.
struggle because he had no budget and time. Yeah.
Yeah. I get that. And I'm just saying you get the same vibes from Everyone's in LA with John Mulaney. But I don't know about I think the live format works for some things. I think you have to come a bit more. I think it depends on the person that's hosting the live event. Like, speak of the devil.
Speak
we're
the
doing
devil.
A live event right
but,
now.
So the value of live is, right, yes, you can plan, but it's interaction. It is also you're not spending like several days producing it, writing all the jokes, like really fine tuning it. Like, yeah, you can just like do it and make it interesting and entertaining. So I think that's the value there. I don't know if Netflix is innovating on this, because this stuff has existed on network TV, on YouTube and elsewhere, but it is kind of interesting to see history repeat itself, right? To be like,
so
now live events on streaming.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Full circle. Yeah. So I don't know if that answers your question, Simon. You let me know in the chat, but I will say that like, that wasn't really a recommendation for me. It's not a pick. The actual, not even pick, it's like, here's a thing I've been playing. And I mentioned this on Threads recently, and y'all told me about Helldivers and whatever in Hades too. Here's the game I've been playing a lot recently, to the point where like, I will stay up till 2 a.m. to finish this game.
I'm ready.
Are you ready?
I'm
ready. Tell me. It's called Match Factory.
Oh, what is it about?
On iOS.
What is it about?
And it's basically another iteration of that Candy Crush format.
There you go.
It's
there
basically,
you go.
Here's what it is. And I'll pull it up for y'all to look at too. I'll just like, I'll sacrifice one round if y'all need, okay? But it's called Match Factory. And it's basically every round you're presented with this like clusterfudge of crap. And it's a lot of like messy objects. And then you have to sort through them. You have to like match them up, and it's 3D too. So like here, you can't see on the audio version of this podcast, but on the live stream, you can see like it starts out with this giant mess of stuff, right? And then you have to like pull together the same items and match them so they go away. And then you fill up a row at the bottom. Anyway.
Yeah, we need to find Trillin like a meditation game, like a game that doesn't involve like reorganizing giant messes, which is literally all we do all day, right? Basically.
I mean, that there's that moving game. Yeah. There was Overcooked. I love
the moving game is good.
What I was gonna tie back to Hades too is that like, if a game isn't just repetitive action over and over, and if I have to think more than like, you know, if I had to coordinate my fighting, you know, I would not. I don't think it's the sort of thick game for me. This is my jam right here.
I get it.
Like,
I get
Match Factory mess.
I'm just saying, you know, you can broaden your horizons. I think you could do some.
I will try
some stuff, some gameplay.
But this got me hooked, and I am so tired this week
because of these games. Curse these like little the things that just trigger the sort of like lizard brain part of us that just wants to like solve these puzzles and stuff. Okay. All right, Trillin. I'm not surprised by this, but I hope you get to experience Hades at some point. I want to shout out real quick. Of all things, The Phantom Menace, Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. I saw it. It's in theaters on like a, you know, it's about 25 years now. It's been making the rounds. I think they're going to do all the prequels. I saw it because I have not seen this movie in a very long time. And also, I was sort of intrigued by rewatching it now in hindsight after seeing too much Star Wars and kind of comparing it to everything that came. So I've been thinking about it so much. I just woke up, you know, Monday morning. I was like, I'm just going to write about The Phantom Menace for Engadget. So I wrote a piece about why The Phantom Menace is kind of more intriguing to me now and how I'm learning to appreciate it. And I'll say this, if you watched it in theaters originally or if you grew up hating it, I think it's probably worth rewatching right now because there are interesting things about The Phantom Menace. The fact that there's so much interesting design work, so many of the worlds and sets and everything feel so real. It is pioneering. It pioneered like CG characters too, no matter what you think of Jar Jar. It is fascinating to see like it implemented back then. I think more and more, the more we're seeing like Star Wars stuff and Marvel stuff shot in the volume or that weird stage where they virtualize the backgrounds, there's something real and gritty about The Phantom Menace. There's puppet work. There's a lot of physical sets and environmental work. It just felt nice. And also just, I take what I like about that movie and then I sort of like reject the rest and sort of like craft the ideal movie in my head. But it is worth seeing in theaters. The pod race is still good. Duel of the Fates, the final fight is still amazing. So it's good stuff. And also if you go see this, you see a preview of Star Wars Acolyte or The Acolyte, which is the upcoming series, which also stars Carrie-Anne Moss. And let me tell you, I was excited for this. And then I watched this extended preview and I'm like, oh, they're just doing Crouching Tiger. They're doing Crouching Tiger in the Star Wars. It's like full on Wuxia fighting, like full on. They do it's basically the tea house fight from Crouching Tiger. It just opens with that, with somebody approaching Trinity. And like having her have force powers, I got chills. And the fight ends and she asks this unnamed fighter, who trained you? And I kind of love that. That is very much the Crouching Tiger thing of like, oh, this young warrior, where are you from? Who trained your skills? I dig that. I dig the vibes. I'm very excited about the Acolyte as well, which is, I think, coming in a couple weeks. So yeah, Star Wars stuff, man. It is worth seeing The Phantom Menace in theaters. You may think I'm crazy, but do it. It is worth it. It's good for you.
Well, that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elmett. You can find Devendra online at...
Devendra on Twitter, Mastodon, Blue Sky, all over the place. And I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me your very non-suspicious reasons for squeezing the Apple Pencil Pro, you can send them to me. I'm still on, I guess, Twitter at ShirlinLo or on Threads at ShirlinStagram. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes or your podcast platform of choice, and subscribe wherever you get podcasts.